Okay, so let's dive into this case. Stephen Michael Ritter, the city of Springfield. It's a pretty big one, especially for, folks headed into litigation.
Oh, absolutely. It's a treasure trove, really, when it comes to sanctions law.
Yeah, Rule 11, attorney fees under Section 1927. It really drives home that in law, like dotting your I's and crossing your let's matters just as much as, the actual substance of the case.
Couldn't agree more. At the heart of it, this case is all about, when a court can actually step in and penalize attorneys for how they handle litigation. It's about the checks and balances in the system. Makes it clear that, there are consequences if you're pursuing claims, or even defenses for that matter, in a way that's, well, improper. We'll be looking at that for sure, how the actual merits of the case kind of intertwine with all the procedural steps you got to take.
Exactly. And we've really dug deep here, gone through a really thorough analysis to unpack all the nuances, got a good, solid case brief for that bird's eye view, and of course, some really focused notes to help us pull out the most important, the key takeaways. So our mission today, pretty straightforward, is to extract those core lessons from Ritter. When are Rule 11 sanctions on the table? What can trigger those attorney fee awards under Section 1927? And, why is it so crucial, especially if you're thinking courtroom career, to really, really have a strong grasp of procedural rules? Not just helpful, essential. Okay, so first things first, let's set the stage here. What were the basic facts in Ritter's case?
All right, so we have Stephen Ritter, and he filed a lawsuit under Section 1983 against the city of Springfield. Now, his claim, it all stemmed from his arrest and pretrial incarceration on rape charges. But here's the thing, and this is what makes it so interesting. He was later fully exonerated by DNA evidence.
Wow, exonerated by DNA evidence. And even after that, he decided to sue the city.
He did. His argument was that the Springfield police, they violated his due process rights. Specifically, he said they didn't disclose some statements from the victim that were actually inconsistent, and they also failed to properly investigate his alibis.
Okay, I mean, those sound like pretty serious allegations of police misconduct.
They do. But here's where it gets interesting. As his claims move through the courts, you start to see a pattern. His lawsuits, they kept getting dismissed.
Dismissed.
Yeah, the courts consistently found that there just wasn't enough evidence to back up his claims. And this was especially true when it came to showing that the city itself was liable, not just individual officers.
Ah, so this brings us to a landmark case in civil rights law, especially when you're talking about suing a whole municipality. Monell v. Department of Social Services. For our listeners who might be, less familiar with this, can you give us a quick breakdown of why Monell is so important here?
Of course. So Monell, it basically established that a city, or county for that matter, can't be held liable under Section 1983 simply because, one of its employees messed up, even if that employee violated someone's constitutional rights. To actually hold the municipality responsible, you have to show that the violation was the result of a specific policy that the city had in place, or, some widespread custom or practice. So in Ritter's case, the courts, they just didn't see any evidence suggesting those alleged failures in the investigation. They weren't the result of some official policy or some deeply ingrained custom within the Springfield police or, the city itself.
So even with the DNA exoneration, even with the allegations about the investigation, he couldn't connect those dots, couldn't prove that it was a symptom of a larger problem, a systemic issue with how the city operated.
Exactly. And, after going through a whole series of legal proceedings, the magistrate judge ultimately granted summary judgment in favor of Springfield and the other defendants. Basically, the court decided, look, based on everything we've seen, there's no real dispute about the key facts here. The defendants, they win as a matter of law. Case closed, right?
Right. So the city wins the initial lawsuit, but there's a twist, right? Because Springfield didn't just stop there. They decided to go after Ritter's attorney for sanctions.
They did, and this is where it gets really interesting.
Yeah. So what were the core legal issues that the court had to grapple with at this point?
Well, there were two big ones. First, were Rule 11 sanctions actually appropriate in this case, especially considering there was a procedural hiccup, a misstep that Springfield made? And second, was it justified to award those attorney fees to Springfield under Section 1927?
Ah, okay. So two separate but related issues. And how did the Sixth Circuit, how did they ultimately rule on these points?
Okay, so they decided that the Rule 11 sanctions, those had to be thrown out, vacated. And the reason? Springfield messed up procedurally. They didn't stick to what's called the safe harbor provision. However, they did uphold the attorney fees awarded under Section 1927. So kind of a mixed bag for Springfield.
Interesting. Won some, lost some. Let's dig a little deeper into this whole safe harbor thing under Rule 11. What exactly is it, and why did it end up being so important in overturning those sanctions?
Right. So the safe harbor provision in Rule 11, think of it as a crucial safety net, a procedural protection. What it says is, if you're planning to file a motion for sanctions against the other side, you're saying they submitted something frivolous like pleadings or other court documents, you can't just spring it on them. First, you got to serve them with that motion.
Okay, give them a heads up.
Yeah, but here's the key. You have to do this a full 21 days before you actually file that motion with the court.
So it's like a warning shot, right? A chance for them to say, whoops, maybe we should rethink this and avoid any further penalties.
Exactly. It's all about encouraging parties to work things out themselves, outside the court, and to prevent a flood of unnecessary motions for sanctions hitting the judge's desk.
Makes sense. So where did Springfield go wrong with this? What did they do?
Well, they kind of dropped the ball. They filed their Rule 11 motion after the judge had already granted that summary judgment, you know, wrapping the whole case up. They completely missed that 21-day window. Didn't give Ritter's attorney any chance to fix things.
Oof, that's a big miss.
Huge. And the Sixth Circuit, they were crystal clear about this. They said, look, safe harbor isn't a suggestion. It's not a friendly guideline. It's mandatory. You have to follow it. And because Springfield didn't, they said, sorry, those Rule 11 sanctions, they got to go. They're improper. Yeah. The court actually said, and I'm quoting here, Rule 11 sanctions are unavailable unless the motion for sanctions is served on the opposing party for the full 21-day safe harbor period before it is filed with or presented to the court. This service and filing must occur prior to final judgment or judicial rejection of the offending contention. I mean, it doesn't get much clearer than that.
Wow, no wiggle room there. So even if the court thought, yeah, Ritter's attorney maybe did something wrong, something that would normally justify sanctions, because Springfield didn't follow the procedure, the right steps, they couldn't get those sanctions, it really shows that, you know, it's not just about being right. It's about doing things the right way.
Right. Absolutely. Procedural missteps, they can completely derail your case. And this case is a stark reminder of that. Okay, let's switch gears a bit. Let's talk about those attorney fees that Springfield did get, those that were awarded under Section 1927. What does it take to get hit with those? What's the legal standard there?
So, as I understand it, Section 1927 allows a court to make an attorney pay for extra costs, expenses, you know, attorney fees, but only if those were racked up because of that attorney's actions, and only if those actions were, well, unreasonably and vexatiously multiplying the proceedings. That sounds like a tough standard to meet.
It is. It really is. The court has to be convinced that the attorney, they weren't just wrong. They were acting in a way that was objectively unreasonable, and that their actions actually made the case more expensive or dragged it out longer than necessary. In this case, the Sixth Circuit agreed with the magistrate judge's decision. They said, yeah, Ritter's lawyer, Dwight D. Brannon, he crossed the line.
Okay, so what exactly did Mr. Brannon do that the court found to be unreasonable and vexatious? What did he do wrong?
The court, they zeroed in on the fact that Brannon just kept going after Springfield, kept pushing these claims long after it should have been obvious, like crystal clear, that the claims were, well, baseless. Especially after discovery, you know, when all the evidence is supposed to be on the table. They basically said, look, any competent attorney, after seeing what came out in discovery, or rather what didn't come out, they would realize these claims, especially against the city, that whole Monell thing, it just wasn't going to fly. And this raises a really important point, you know, for all of us future lawyers out there. What are some red flags, some early warnings that we should be watching for, those signs that a claim might not be as strong as it initially seemed?
Yeah, and there's a quote from the court that really captures this. They said, Mr. Brannon pursued the case against Springfield long after it should have become clear that the claims lacked any plausible factual basis. So it wasn't just that he lost, it's that he kept fighting even when the evidence wasn't there.
Right, exactly. And this is where you see a really important difference between Rule 11 and Section 1927. See, Rule 11, it's often about those initial pleadings. Are they frivolous from the get-go? And it has that safe harbor to give everyone a chance to correct things early.
Yeah.
But Section 1927, it takes a wider lens. It's about punishing misconduct that happens during the whole case, like dragging things out unnecessarily when it's clear you're not going to win. And crucially, Section 1927 doesn't have that safe harbor thing.
Ah, okay, that makes the different outcomes in this case much clearer. So, to recap, Section 1927, that's about the lawyer's behavior during the case, like stubbornly sticking to a losing strategy. Rule 11 is more about the initial filings, and, well, Springfield really fumbled that procedurally.
Exactly. Okay, now let's loop back to why Ritter's initial claims against the city failed in the first place. And it really boils down to that key ingredient, proving municipal liability under Monell. Can you walk us through that again, why it was such a major roadblock for Ritter?
Sure. As we discussed earlier, Monell sets a really specific bar for suing a city or town under Section 1983. It's not enough to say, hey, one of your employees did something wrong. You have to prove that whatever constitutional violation happened, it was a direct result of an official policy that the city had, or maybe a widespread custom and established practice, something like that. In Ritter's situation, even with those allegations about the police investigation, the courts just didn't find any evidence linking those alleged problems to some kind of systemic issue within the Springfield police or a citywide policy. You got to have that link. Without it, the city itself can't be held liable.
And that missing piece, that lack of evidence for municipal liability, it played a big part in the court's decision to uphold those Section 1927 sanctions against Ritter's attorney.
Yeah.
He kept pushing that case even after discovery showed there wasn't really anything to support that crucial Monell claim.
All right, so big picture time. If we're aspiring litigators, what are the big, the absolutely must-remember lessons from Stephen Michael Ritter v. City of Springfield?
I'd say there are a few. First and foremost, this case screams, it shouts, know the rules of procedure and follow them. Rule 11's safe harbor provision, that's not just some technicality you can ignore. It's a requirement, plain and simple. And like we saw here, even messing up a seemingly small procedural step can have huge consequences. Even if your argument for sanctions is valid, if you don't do it the right way, you're out of luck. Procedural rules matter. They matter a lot.
You really can't overstate that, especially when you're starting out. What else should we take away from this?
This case also throws a spotlight on the ethical duties we'll have as attorneys. We have to constantly be assessing our case, looking at it with a critical eye, especially as it develops. It's not enough to file a lawsuit and just assume everything's going to fall into place. As you go through discovery, more facts come out, you get a clearer picture, and we have an obligation to reassess. The evidence isn't there. If it's weak, we can't just keep pushing a case that's clearly going nowhere. That can get you slapped with sanctions under Section 1927, and frankly, it can really damage your reputation as a lawyer.
And finally, we have to really grasp the difference between Rule 11 and Section 1927. They deal with different kinds of attorney misconduct, and they have different hoops you got to jump through procedurally. Knowing when to use which one and how to use it correctly, that's essential. It can save you and your clients a lot of headaches down the line.
Couldn't agree more. Rule 11, think initial filings, frivolous stuff right out of the gate. And remember that safe harbor provision, Section 1927, that's about misconduct that makes the case drag on unnecessarily. No safe harbor there. Knowing the nuances, that's what makes you a good lawyer.
All right, so just to wrap this up, the big, big takeaways from Stephen Michael Ritter v. City of Springfield. Follow the rules, especially those procedural ones. Don't try to bend or break them because it will come back to bite you. And as attorneys, we have a duty to make sure our case is solid, not just at the beginning, but throughout the entire process. Don't be afraid to reevaluate, to adjust your strategy, or even to walk away if the evidence just isn't there. Otherwise, you're risking sanctions under Section 1927, and that's not a good look.
Absolutely. Spot on. Now, here's something to think about. That safe harbor rule in Rule 11, it gives a party 21 days to either fix what they filed or withdraw it. But what does that mean strategically? How could you use a well-timed Rule 11 motion, served correctly, of course, to maybe influence the other side's whole strategy? Could it even push them towards a settlement? And ethically, when do we as lawyers, when do we have to really sit down and say, okay, this isn't working. We need to seriously rethink our client's position. These are the kinds of questions that, you know, they take you beyond just memorizing the rules. They make you think like a real lawyer, a responsible advocate.
Absolutely. Great food for thought. Thanks for joining me for this deep dive.
My pleasure. Always happy to dig into these fascinating cases.